as she and Ben left for Newark's Penn Station, where they'd board the Silver Meteor to Miami. "Postcards," Rusty mumbled as the car pulled away. So, on this late March day, Miri was the one to pick up the mail. She'd already walked Mason and Fred to Edison Lanes, where a bum came out of nowhere, pulling on Mason's sleeve, frightening Miri. He was filthy, and he reeked of alcohol.
"Get off me," Mason told him. "Come on, son. You're a big shot now, a hero," the bum said. "People must be throwing money at you. How about something for your dear old dad?"
She could see the anger in Mason's face, his jaw tightening, his teeth clenched.
"I said, get off me."
The bum looked at Miri.
"Who's this? Your girlfriend?"
"Don't touch her," Mason said, shielding Miri with his body. Fred barked.
"Well, well, it's Fred, is it?"
He tried to pet the dog, but Fred growled. Miri had never heard Fred growl.
"If you don't get out of here, I'm calling the police,"
Mason said.
"I am the police, son."
"You were the police, but not anymore. And stop calling me son."
"Jackie always gives me a fiver."
"Yeah, to get rid of you."
"You want to get rid of me, son? Give me some change."
"Let's go," Mason said, grabbing Miri's hand. He led her inside, but turned back to the bum once and called,
"You better be gone when I come out. You hear? You better be gone."
He wouldn't let Miri leave until the coast was clear.
"I'm sorry you had to see that drunken excuse of a father," he told her.
That was his father? The father who'd chased him with an axe? Miri was still reeling when she dropped Fred at Mrs. Stein's house. She walked home looking over her shoulder, making sure the bum who was Mason's father wasn't following her. It must be terrible having a father like him, Miri thought. Someone you couldn't trust, someone so unpredictable. Better to have no father, or a father in California you never had to see. She let herself into the house, collected the mail from the floor, where it had come in through the slot in the door, and thumbed through it, separating Irene's and Henry's from hers and Rusty's. There was a postcard for her from Irene, showing a wide white beach with one palm tree leaning toward the blue-green ocean. The third postcard this week. Each one had a message beginning, "Darling Miri." Then there would be a one-line message, "Wish you were here," or "You would love this weather," or "Having a wonderful time." She tucked the postcard into the waistband of her skirt and headed upstairs, where she dropped the mail on the kitchen table. On top was a creamy white envelope addressed to Naomi Ammerman in slanted handwriting that looked vaguely familiar. She turned it over to find an engraved return address. Mrs. J.J. Strasser, Redmond Road, South Orange, New Jersey. Why was Frecky writing to Rusty? She didn't like this. She sat at the kitchen table for a while, considering her options. Maybe she should steam the envelope open, read the letter, then re-glue the envelope. Suzanne had done that once with a letter to her parents from her sister Dory, the one who'd been expelled by Mr. Royer. She'd run off with a guy her parents didn't approve of before she'd graduated from high school. Another option, she could open it, read it, then burn it, or hide it in her sock drawer, the way she'd hidden the letter from Mike Monsky. But she wouldn't want Rusty to do that to her. Rusty, who said trust was the single most important part of a relationship. "Remember that, Miri. If you can't trust, you can't love." It was bad enough she'd hidden Mike Monsky's letter. But that was, at least, addressed to her. This was different. Rusty would be home soon enough. Without Irene to cook for them, they'd been eating pizza, deli sandwiches, or scrambled eggs for supper. But tonight, they were going to have a roast chicken. Rusty had left instructions from Irene. Miri was to light the oven, season the chicken, and put it in to roast. "You can't go wrong with a roast chicken, baked potatoes, and fresh carrots," Irene told her before she'd left. She'd never tell Irene that Rusty had picked up bird's-eye frozen carrots instead of fresh. At 6 o'clock, Miri heard the front door open, and Rusty sang, "I'm home!" She came up the stairs and into the kitchen, where Miri was basting the chicken, per Irene's instructions. "It smells good in here," Rusty said, kicking off her shoes and getting out of her coat. She bent over and dropped a kiss on top of Miri's head. Then she picked up the mail and riffled through it. Miri was almost afraid to watch. She opened Frecky's note first. Her breathing changed as she read it. "What the hell is this?"
"What?" Miri asked. "Did somebody die?"
Rusty waved the note in front of Miri's face.
"You met him? You met Mike Monsky and you never told me."
"Mom, I..."
"How could you keep such a secret from me? I'm your mother, for God's sake. How could you betray me this way?"
"Mom, I'd never..."
"Don't lie to me.
I'm not lying. What does it say?"
Rusty shoved the note at Miri, and she grabbed it, reading quickly. It said that Mike Monsky was in town and wanted to make a plan regarding their daughter, a plan that would include financial support and visiting rights. It said ever since Mike met Miri, he'd been thinking about her. Frecky suggested they meet in the study of Rabbi Biederman, who counsels many families in difficult situations. Rusty should also feel free to consult a lawyer.
"Feel free to consult a lawyer?" Miri asked.
"Feel free," Rusty repeated. "Who does that bitch think she is?"
Rusty went crazy, throwing her shoes against the wall.
"He thinks he can walk into my life and destroy everything just like he did 16 years ago? I'll kill him first."
Miri was sure that at that moment, Rusty meant it. Her ferocity scared Miri.
"Did you think I'd never find out?" she asked Miri.
"Frecky fooled me. She never said he'd be at Grunnings."
"Grunnings? My God! You had ice cream with him?"
"I'm sorry, Mom. I didn't know what to do."
"You should have told me the minute you got home. I'd have stopped this immediately. I'd have warned Frecky and her brother. If they ever, ever contacted you again, I'd have them arrested. That's what you should have done. You can't trust him, Miri. Don't let that smile fool you, those eyes."
"I don't trust him. I don't even like him. I never want to see him again."
This wasn't completely true. She was curious about her mother and him.
"What bothers me is you didn't tell me. You kept it a secret, and now Frecky is asking for a meeting. I trusted you to go to the paper mill playhouse with Frecky. I trusted you, Miri."
"But, Mom, I didn't know he'd be there."
"What's going on?"
Henry called from the foyer. They hadn't heard him come in.
"A situation,"
Rusty called back. Henry ran up the stairs two at a time and burst into the kitchen.
"Mama?"
he asked Rusty, and Miri could read the fear in his eyes.
"No,"
Rusty told him.
"Mike Monsky has surfaced." "Mike Monsky?"
Henry said this as if they were talking about Frankenstein.
"And guess what?"
Rusty said.
"Miri's met him, but didn't think she needed to tell me."
Henry gave Miri a questioning look, but Miri didn't say anything.
"And now Frecky's cooked up some mishigas about getting together with a Rabbi Biederman," Rusty said, "to make a plan."
"A plan?"
Henry asked. Miri handed him Frecky's note. Henry read it.
"I know a good lawyer," he said. "I'm sure he'll advise us as a family friend."
The lawyer, Greg Bender, came over after dinner. He and Henry were old friends. They used to play basketball together at the Y. Rusty made coffee.
"She doesn't want to see him," Rusty told Greg Bender, offering cream and sugar for his coffee and a plate of store-bought cookies. "Isn't that right, Miri? Isn't that what you told me?"
"I did say that."
"There," Rusty said. "You see? If she never wants to see him again, why should we agree to have this meeting? Can someone please explain that to me?"
Did you mean it? Henry asked Miri. Are you afraid of him?
No, I'm not afraid of him. And no, I didn't really mean it. But how am I supposed to let you know that without Rusty going crazy?
I understand how you feel, Rusty, Greg Bender said. But this is about Miri's future. As I see it, this could be an opportunity. Let's say Mr. Monsky puts away a nest egg for her education.
I've already started a savings account for her education, Rusty said. Every week since I started working, I've put something into it.
So have I,
Henry said, surprising Miri.
It's not a lot, but it'll help pay for her tuition.
Thank you, Uncle Henry, Miri whispered, afraid if she said anything more, she'd start bawling.
You see, Rusty said to Greg, we have it all worked out. So why should we say yes to Frecky and her brother?
For one thing, to avoid this matter going to court, Greg said, to keep it friendly.
Friendly? Rusty gave a false laugh. That's a good one.
For another.
And now Greg looked at Miri.
Because she has a right to know her father.
He is no father.
Rusty turned on her heel and headed for her bedroom. She slammed the door like a frustrated, angry teenager.
This is very hard for Rusty,
Henry said. Greg nodded.
I imagine so.
Miri wanted to say, what about me? Don't you think it's hard for me? But she didn't.
Rabbi Biederman's house was on a quiet street in Maplewood, in a neighborhood of pretty old houses with flowering trees and lawns that would soon be green. Daffodils and tulips were sprouting. Miri might have sat in the rumble seat today if Henry still had his old coupe, but he'd given that to Leah, so she no longer had to take the bus to work, and he drove a new Chevy. He'd gotten a good deal on last year's model. Nobody wanted a maroon car. They passed a church as they turned onto the rabbi's street. Wasn't it strange for a rabbi to live near a church? The lawyer, Greg Bender, was already there, parked in his car, waiting for them. The rabbi was clean-shaven, dressed in weekend clothes, a tweed jacket over a blue Oxford cloth shirt, no tie. She'd never seen a rabbi out of his robes. She'd never thought of a rabbi having a nice house on a nice street in a good neighborhood, wearing regular clothes, having a wife and kids. He welcomed them into a book-lined room with a sofa and four club chairs around a coffee table. Photos of his children at different ages were scattered around the room. Henry made the introductions.
Glad to meet you, Rabbi, he said, shaking hands. I'm Henry Ammerman. This is my sister, Rusty Ammerman, my niece, Miri Ammerman, and Greg Bender, our lawyer, who is here as a family friend. Welcome to all of you, the rabbi said. I admire your work, Mr. Ammerman. Please, make yourselves comfortable. We have coffee and Danish. Miri, would you like a glass of milk or orange juice?
No, thank you.
Greg Bender helped himself to a cheese Danish and a cup of coffee. Henry did the coffee thing, too. Rusty fidgeted with her pocketbook, pulling out a linen handkerchief, embroidered on one corner. She was probably hoping Frecky and Mike Monsky wouldn't show up. But as the church bells chimed 10 times, Frecky strutted in arm with Mike Monsky and another man behind them. Frecky said,
"Hello, Rabbi. I'm Frecky Strasser, and this is my brother, Mike Monsky, and my husband, Dr. J.J. Strasser."
Her husband, not her lawyer. Miri was surprised. She was sure Frecky would bring a lawyer.
Miri tried not to look at Mike Monsky, who was focused on Rusty, who was picking non-existent lint off her skirt. Only then did Miri notice that Rusty was wearing her new peep-toe pumps and the pale green sweater dress that made her eyes look even more green. Her hair was loose, down to her shoulders. She looked especially pretty, though tense and unsmiling, twisting the linen handkerchief in her hands. Frecky wore a stylish wool skirt and matching sweater set in spring colors, navy and white. Miri was almost sure it was cashmere. A matching silk scarf was draped around her neck. Mary wondered how she got the scarf to stay in place. Her doctor husband checked his watch, explaining he was on call and might have to leave early. He hoped they would understand if he did.
"Let me begin by stating the obvious," Rabbi Biederman said. "This isn't an easy situation for any of you. Mary, you're the one caught in the middle."
Frecky interrupted.
"She's not caught in the middle, Rabbi. She's the one who will benefit most from this arrangement."
The rabbi said,
"Emotionally, Mary is in the middle."
Maybe this rabbi was smarter than she'd thought.
"Can we cut to the chase, please?" Rusty said.
"Rabbi, if I may."
Mike Monsky looked to the rabbi for permission to continue.
"Please,"
the rabbi said, signaling for Mike Monsky to speak.
"We made a mistake 16 years ago,
he began, looking directly at Rusty. He was calling her a mistake? Did she really have to sit here and listen to this?
"But the result of that mistake," he continued, "is a wonderful young girl who nobody in their right mind would ever call a mistake. I'm proud to call her my daughter."
"She's no more your daughter than I'm the Queen of Sheba," Rusty said.
"She's entitled to have a relationship with her father," Mike said.
"You call yourself a father?" Rusty asked. "I can show you fathers, responsible, loving men who are there for their families."
Henry leaned over and whispered something to Rusty. Rusty blew her nose in the linen handkerchief. Frecky said,
"Nobody doubts you've done a wonderful job, Rusty. You've raised a lovely daughter, but you can't deny her a father."
Rusty's face turned red.
"I've never denied her anything."
But the truth, Mary thought. She wished she could shout at them to stop, but then everyone in the room would look at her. As if reading her mind, the rabbi said,
"Miriam, would you like to speak?"
She shook her head no, but there was plenty she might have said if she'd had the courage.
"I have a father," she'd say to Rusty. "You might not like him, but you can't pretend he doesn't exist. If you don't like him, you should have thought of that before you got into his mash with the seat that turned into a bed."
Next, she'd look directly at Mike Monsky. "You think you can waltz into my life now and everything will be okay? You expect me to trust you just because you and my mother shtupped a couple of times? Trust has to be earned. You know who taught me that? My mother. You've never taught me anything, not anything good anyway."
Then back to Rusty. "Stop arguing. Let him put money away for college. You know you worry about how you're going to pay. You think I don't know that for 15 years you've done everything? You and Nana and Uncle Henry. You think I don't know what a family I have? A family I can count on. I don't need him. That's true. But if it turns out I want to know him, if it turns out I want to meet his other kids, so what? That doesn't change anything between us. I love you, Mom. Don't worry. You're not going to lose me. Ever."
Henry gave her a little nudge, and she came back from her fantasy in time to hear Rusty say,
"I don't want his money, Rabbi. I've managed all these years on my own." "But the child is entitled, Mrs. Ammerman. I'm suggesting Mr. Monsky set up a fund for Mary,"
the rabbi said,
"to help with college expenses. Perhaps the amount can be decided by your lawyers. You are entitled to nothing, Mr. Monsky. It will be up to Mary if she wants to see you or not. At 15, she can make that decision herself."
Her feelings for this rabbi just went from cool to warm.
"That sounds fair,"
Mike Monsky said. Greg looked at Henry, who nodded, and at Rusty, who shrugged.
Then the rabbi asked, "Do you want to see your father again?"
"I don't know," Mary answered.
"I understand,"
the rabbi said.
"Personally, I think you owe it to yourself to get to know him, even though he hasn't yet had the chance to show you
what kind of father he will be. I hope he'll be responsible, kind, supportive. But that's going to take some time, some proving. Maybe a week over the summer? Think about it.
Miri nodded. Rusty blew her nose again.
Mrs. Strasser, the rabbi said, thank you for bringing these two families together.
Frecky nodded.
Mr. Monsky, the rabbi continued, your wife is Jewish? She's a convert, rabbi. The boys are being raised Jewish. It's a way of life for us.
The rabbi said,
good, very good.
Henry stood and shook hands with the rabbi. So did the others. Then Henry shook hands with Mike Monsky. When Mike extended his hand to Rusty, she didn't want to take it, Miri could tell. But finally, with Henry's urging, she held out her hand. Mike Monsky took it and said,
you're even more beautiful now than you were then.
Rusty gave him a kind of ha, without smiling.
You haven't changed, she said. You've still got a line a mile long. It was always the truth, Mike Monsky told her, whether you believed it or not.
Rusty turned, took Henry's arm, and walked out the door.
That wasn't so bad, was it?
Frecky said to Miri. I guess that depends on who you ask, Miri told her. Mike Monsky put his hand on Miri's shoulder.
I hope you'll decide to give me a chance. I hope you'll come for a visit this summer, like the rabbi suggested.
Maybe, Miri said.
All right,
Mike Monsky said. Miri nodded.
Can I have a hug?
He asked. Not here. Not now. And she hurried to catch up to Rusty and Henry. Leah had invited them to stop at Aunt Alma's house for brunch after the meeting. Before she got out of the car, Rusty changed from her new pumps into her comfy weekend flats. Leah came outside to greet them. Henry said something to her in private, probably telling her how it went at Rabbi Biederman's, probably warning her not to bring up the subject. Alma's house was small and neat like her, barely big enough for two. Once Leah and Henry were married, she'd have it back to herself again. Miri wondered if she'd be sorry or glad to see Leah go. Inside, it was decorated in old-world style, with crocheted doilies on the arms of the sofas and chairs. Rusty took one look at the whitefish salad, the lox and bagels, and said, "This looks like an after-funeral lunch." Leah looked hurt. Henry put his arm around her.
"Come on, Rusty. Nobody's died."
Rusty was quick to apologize. "I'm sorry, Leah. I didn't mean... It's very sweet of you and Alma to have us over."
"I hear Irene is in Miami Beach," Alma said, "with that nice Mr. Sapphire."
"Yes," Rusty said, "and she seems to be enjoying it." "Mr. Sapphire's apartment has two bedrooms," Miri said, feeling she had to defend Irene's honor.
"Maybe he could invite me down to stay in the second bedroom," Alma said. "I wouldn't mind getting away from this crazy weather, spring or winter, winter or spring. You never know from day to day, pneumonia weather."
"Well," Henry said, "I'm famished. Let's eat."
"Me too," Miri said. Even Rusty helped herself to a bagel piled with lox, cream cheese, and tomato. They'd made it through. They'd survived the stormy seas of Frecky and Mike Monsky, at least for today.
"Are we going to tell Nana about this?" Miri asked.
"When the time is right," Rusty said.
"What do you think she'll say?"
Henry answered.
"I think she'll say it's a good thing for a girl to know her father, so she can make up her own mind about him."
Mike Monsky. He wasn't sure he should have let his sister talk him into this. She was a bossy big sister when he was a kid, and she was still a bossy big sister. A bossy wife, too, he was betting. He was sure the good doctor who'd married her didn't know what he was in for. And now,
J.J. Strasser wasn't thrilled about complicating his life with Frecky's long-lost brother or some recently found niece. That was pretty clear. But Frecky had some nutty idea this daughter of his had to be rescued. From what, he didn't know. He'd made the right decision staying on the West Coast after the war, marrying Adela. So he'd told a little white lie to the rabbi this morning about how she'd converted and how they were raising their boys in the Jewish faith, as if his in-laws would have gone for that. It was bad enough when their only daughter was marrying a Jew, and the Jew was going to be working in the family business. But, okay, according to his father-in-law, he was a good-looking guy. You couldn't tell he was a Jew from just looking, and his own son had been Mike's shipmate in the Pacific. That counted for something, didn't it? That he'd even made it into the Navy, which didn't favor Jews, was, in itself, a statement. This was no pasty-faced faggot who tried to get out of serving his country. As long as he, Rufus Collingwood, didn't have to meet Mike's family, and thank God he'd already changed his name to Monk. Mr. Collingwood had said this to Mike, face-to-face, man-to-man. No problem there. Mike had told Frecky he and Adela had eloped, when the truth was, they'd had 200 to a sit-down dinner with dancing at the country club, where he, Michael Monk, was now a member. Mike and Frecky had grown up in the Weakwake section of Newark. In high school, he was Mr. Popularity. The girls loved him. As a student, just so-so. Still, he'd gone to Rutgers, played basketball, joined Phi Ep, where he'd met Rusty at a party in February of his junior year. He fell for her before they'd exchanged two words. Hell, who wouldn't have fallen for her? She looked like a movie star, maybe Rita Hayworth with green eyes. Had he ever met a girl with green eyes? He didn't think so. She was tall and lanky. But he was cocky, came on too strong, scared her off. She was just a senior in high school, while he was a BMOC. He reminded himself to take it slow and easy. He couldn't take his eyes off her today in the rabbi's study. It all came rushing back. Her scent, the silky feel of her skin, the long hair wrapped around his fingers. And she'd loved it, hadn't she? She was always ready to hop into the Nash for hours of kissing, touching, and finally, bingo, the night she gave in. After he demonstrated the bed in a car, she wanted to do it again. He remembered because the Hauptmann guy, the one convicted of killing the Lindbergh baby, was executed in New Jersey the same night. Mike hadn't been strapped into the electric chair like Hauptmann, but he'd been on fire for that girl. It lasted until 4th of July weekend, when he drank too much at a party down the shore and made a pass at some other girl, a mistake, and one that cost him. Rusty wouldn't stop crying, and it was never the same between them. No more make-out sessions in the Nash or anywhere else. From what he heard, she was relieved when he enlisted. And so was he. There were plenty of other girls waiting. Anchors away, my boys. Anchors away. His parents were ready to kill him. A Jewish boy enlists in 1936 in peacetime? Are you crazy? His father shouted. Okay, so college didn't go the way it should have. You were sowing your wild oats. You'll go to summer school, make up the two classes you flunked. You'll do better next year. If war comes and we get the contract for military uniforms, we'll be rich. You can work with me. Eli Tucker would give you a medical excuse. You have flat feet like me, don't you? We'll be making the uniforms instead of wearing them. Come on, son, say it was a mistake. And now, today, in the rabbi's study, 16 years later, and she looks the same, better, if that's possible. He's never cheated on Adela, not that he hasn't been tempted. But this was different. He doubted he'd have the strength to resist, should she be interested, mother of his daughter and all that. Elizabeth Daily Post. A-bomb drill for Times Square. April 5th.
The New York Civil Defense Corps announced an air raid drill for Times Square tonight. The exercise will be programmed as if an atom bomb had exploded and incendiary and high-powered bombs had rained down on the entire amusement area. The drill is timed for the height of pre-show congestion. Traffic will be diverted. Chapter 28. Christina didn't feel married. She still lived at home and slept alone in her small bedroom with the faded pink floral wallpaper. She may have pressed her wedding corsage in her scrapbook, but she hadn't annotated the page in case somebody, her mother, Athena, got suspicious and went looking for clues. At night, she'd take her wedding ring out of her jewelry box where she kept it hidden, pulling on the secret tab that lifted the black velvet false bottom. And even then, she kept the real bottom covered in fabric left over from Yaya's latest sewing project, making dolls for children who'd lost their toys in the crash. She'd lock her bedroom door, slip on the wedding band, and wave her hand around in front of the mirror to see how it looked. Then she'd take it off and kiss it goodnight before hiding it again. Her wedding ring. It must be real if she had a wedding ring. Sometimes she'd say, Christina McKittrick, just to see how it sounded. She'd caught herself at school, scribbling her married name in her notebook, but she always stopped in time and erased the evidence. After school and on Saturdays, she'd hurried to Dr. O's office. Since she got her period, which she knew could have been a miscarriage, she'd been thinking about seeing a doctor, but she didn't know any gynecologists, and she certainly wasn't going to ask her sister to recommend one. Instead, she asked Daisy. She didn't have to tell Daisy anything more than she needed to see a doctor for lady troubles. "I'm so irregular," she said. "I don't want to worry my mother. You know how Greek mothers can be." She hated lying to Daisy. She wasn't irregular at all. Her periods came every 28 days like clockwork, until recently. Daisy wrote down the name and phone number of a doctor, and Christina set up the appointment herself. Dr. J.J. Strasser had a fancy office in Newark. There were obviously pregnant women in the waiting room, and others who weren't, or if they were, they weren't showing yet. Christina twirled her wedding band around on her finger. It was the first time she'd worn it in public. But before it was her turn to see the doctor, she chickened out, slipping it into her change purse. Dr. Strasser listened to her story about why she was here. "I didn't get my period for 2 months, and I've always been regular. Then I got it, and it was especially heavy with cramping."
"Get changed, and we'll see what's going on. Have you had a pelvic exam before, Christina?"
"No." But she knew what was going to happen. He was going to put a speculum into her vagina. She'd read all about it last night. She was scared. But his nurse stood by her side and patted her hand. The speculum was cold and made her shiver, or maybe she shivered because she was scared.
"You're not a virgin," the doctor told her. "I doubt you're going to fool anyone into believing you are, but you never know."
"Actually, I'm married," Christina said, "but nobody knows. We eloped. I was a virgin until then." Technically, this wasn't true, but she wanted this doctor to like her, to treat her well.
"You girls and your secret marriages," the doctor said. "If I had a daughter who did that, I'd never forgive her."
What kind of father can't forgive his daughter? She was glad he wasn't her father. She believed Baba would forgive her anything. It was Mama she was worried about. Dr. Strasser took out the speculum and felt around inside her with his hand, pressing down, making her even more uncomfortable. The nurse told her to breathe.
"I don't see any evidence of a miscarriage. Everything looks fine. Would you like me to fit you for a diaphragm, Mrs.?"
"McKittrick," Christina said, trying it out. "And yes, I'd like a diaphragm." She was so glad she'd read up on her choices last night.
"Do you have your husband's approval to use birth control?"
Her husband's approval? "Yes."
"If you use it properly, and that means every time, you shouldn't have to worry about being pregnant until you want to be." After she was dressed and seated in his office, he said, "I see you're from Elizabeth." She nodded. "Plane Crash City."
"We don't call it that."
She knew people who weren't from Elizabeth did.
Wasn't there a story in the paper about letters to the editor addressed to Plane Crash City, New Jersey?
"Terrible," he said. "A tragedy."
"Three tragedies. And I saw two of them." He looked up.
"That would give you more than enough anxiety to miss your period."
"Yes."
"Newark Airport being closed is a real pain in the neck for me. Every time I want to fly to a conference or take a vacation, I'll have to schlep into New York, all the way to LaGuardia or Idlewild."
"I'm sorry," Christina said. He laughed.
"You're a nice girl, Mrs. McKittrick. Good luck in your marriage."
"Thank you, Dr. Strasser."
"And don't forget, every time."
"What?"
"The diaphragm. It doesn't work if you don't use it."
She asked her parents if she could invite Jack to the house just to say hello. He rescued all those people from the burning plane. Mama and Baba looked at each other. "We're friends."
"They're friends,"
Baba said to Mama. Later, when the doorbell rang, Athena answered. "Hello, Jack."
"Hello, Athena."
"We were in the same year at school," Athena explained to Mama and Baba.
"And now?"
Baba asked Jack.
"What do you do now?" "Now I'm an electrician, sir."
"Your parents are living?" Mama asked.
"I'm afraid not, Mrs. Demetrius." "Family is everything,"
Mama said.
"Yes, it is,"
Jack said.
"You understand our Christina is precious to us,"
Baba said.
"Yes, sir." "And she will marry a Greek boy someday. You understand that, too?"
"I understand your wishes for your daughter, sir, and I respect them."
"Good,"
Baba said. Mama grabbed hold of Baba's arm as if to steady herself. Athena tried to hide a smile. That night they made love using both her new diaphragm and a rubber, because she wasn't sure she was using the diaphragm correctly. She found it complicated and messy. First, you had to put in the jelly and rub it around, making sure you got enough over the rim. Then you had to squeeze it together and insert it into your vagina, getting it up far enough. She'd been practicing in her room at night. When she pulled it out, she had to wash it, pat it dry, and store it in its case, something else she'd have to hide. Or maybe Jack would keep it. Yes, that would make sense. She supposed she'd get used to it. She supposed it would get easier. They were going to be married for a long time, and she didn't want to be pregnant every year like Mrs. O'Malley's daughter, who'd already had 5 babies. But she still wasn't relaxed about going all the way. She supposed she had to give it some time. Elizabeth Daily Post. Rosenbergs get Passover visit. April 9th, UPI. Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, sentenced to die for transmitting A-bomb secrets to the Soviet Union, received a pre-Passover visit at Sing Sing Prison from their 5- and 9-year-old sons. Meanwhile, following today's denial of their last plea to the Court of Appeals, the couple's lawyer said that he would be filing an appeal with the United States Supreme Court. Chapter 29. Miri. Twice a week, Miri sent a card to Natalie at the Watchung Hills Children's Home. "Heard you were under the weather. Well, come on out." Miri wasn't sure Natalie would find any of the cards funny. Half the time, she wasn't sure they were funny. Sometimes she'd include a little note, trying to keep it light, something about school or about a TV show. "Uncle Milty dressed as Carmen Miranda Tuesday night. He wore a hat loaded with bananas, pineapples, and grapes. My mother laughed so hard she almost didn't make it to the bathroom in time." She'd bought all the cards at once at the Ritz bookshop, along with a copy of 17th Summer. She and Natalie had read it together at the beginning of 8th grade, and Miri hoped when and if she had the chance to give it to her, it would remind Natalie of their friendship, because Natalie didn't answer any of Miri's cards or notes.
Irene suggested inviting Mason to their Seder on the first night of Passover, surprising Miri. Miri wore her new patent leather slingbacks. Mason brought lilacs for Irene. They all missed Henry and Leah, who had gone to visit Leah's parents. But Miss Rheingold was there, and Blanche Kessler from the Red Cross with her family, and Ben Sapphire. Corinne called a few days later, another surprise, saying if Miri would like to see Natalie, she would pick her up at school the next afternoon, if that was convenient for her. That night, Miri wrapped the copy of 17th Summer and tied it with one of the ribbons from Irene's collection. "She doesn't know you're coming," Corinne said on the drive to Wachung. "She doesn't want anyone to see her in this place, but the doctors think it might be good for her to begin to reconnect to the outside world." "Is she coming home soon?" "Maybe in time for graduation. Just act as if nothing's changed, as if you're still best friends."
"Aren't we still best friends?" Miri thought, though she didn't say it aloud.
The Wachung Hills Children's Home, a big white house, sat on a hill surrounded by tall trees. The azaleas were in bloom. The grass was very green. Inside, the halls were filled with music and children's laughter. Corinne stopped outside room 218. She knocked on the door before turning the knob.
"Everyone decent?"
She didn't wait for a reply. Miri hung back, anxious, not sure what she'd find inside the room.
"Nat, look who's here," Corinne called,
stepping back to make room for Miri.
"I'll leave you two alone to catch up," she said brightly,
as if there were nothing unusual about Miri visiting Natalie in this place. Then she disappeared. From the look on Natalie's face, first surprise, then anger, followed by disgust, or maybe embarrassment, Miri could see Natalie didn't want her there any more than she wanted to be there.
"Hi,"
Miri said, trying to make her voice sound as bright as Corinne's.
"Hi. I'm glad you're feeling better. I'm alive, if that's what you mean."
Natalie's voice had an edge to it. In the other bed, someone was sleeping. She had the covers pulled up so high, almost her whole head and face were covered. One arm lay outstretched, attached to tubes. Natalie was wearing regular clothes, dungarees, a shirt, and a bulky cardigan sweater. She didn't look any different to Miri than she had that day she went cuckoo in the basement. Well, maybe a little better than that, but not much.
"You were there that day, right?"
Natalie asked.
"Which day?"
"That day I went to the hospital."
"Oh, that day." "You'll never believe who my nurse was."
"Who?"
"Phyllis Kirk's mother."
"Phyllis Kirk, the actress?"
"Yes, isn't that something? And she told me Phyllis is up for a big part in a Vincent Price movie, and it's going to be in 3D.
"What does that mean?" Miri asked.
"I'm not sure."
Now the figure in the other bed sat up. She was so thin, Miri was sure she'd been in a concentration camp. Next to her, Natalie seemed almost healthy. Natalie, at least, had some color in her cheeks. The skeleton said,
"You have to wear special glasses, and it looks like things are jumping out at you."
"How do you know?" Miri asked. The girl shrugged.
"Lulu knows a lot," Natalie said.
So the skeleton had a name.
"How come they let you see a friend?"
Lulu asked Natalie.
"I don't know,"
Natalie said.
"Friends can make you feel worse about yourself,"
Lulu said. "I don't want to do that," Miri told her.
"You don't want to, but you might anyway."
"Should I go?" Miri asked, hoping the answer was yes.
"Why don't you just shut up for once, Lulu?"
Natalie said. Lulu laughed.
"So are you from Plane Crash City, too?"
she asked Miri, swooping her free arm around like a plane taking off, then coming straight down onto her bed.
Boom!
"Come on." Natalie grabbed Miri by the sleeve and pulled her out of the room, then down the hall to a sunroom where other kids had visitors, too. Many of the kids had braces on their legs. Some had crutches. Others were in wheelchairs, their legs straight out in plaster casts.
They had polio, Natalie explained. They're learning to walk again. If you want milk and cookies, they're on a table over there.
She pointed across the room.
What about you? I don't drink milk or eat cookies.
Okay. Miri helped herself to two shortbread cookies and a small cup of milk. She sat down on a sofa next to Natalie.
My hair is growing back, Natalie said.
I didn't know you cut it.
I didn't. It was falling out. From my condition.
Miri was dying to ask, what condition? But she was trying to act ordinary, like it was just another day.
It looks good, like always. Lulu and I are the only freaks here. We didn't have polio, and we don't have cerebral palsy. What's happening at school?
Wait, what do you mean, freaks? Miri wanted to ask.
Instead, she said, school, you know, the usual. Except I was almost expelled.
You? Goody Two-Shoes?
What'd you do?
Wrote a story for the paper Mr. Royer didn't like, so I handed it out on my own.
And I'm not Goody Two-Shoes, she wanted to add, but didn't. The chorus is practicing for graduation. We're singing Younger Than Springtime.
I hate that song.
It's pretty sappy.
What about you? Are you still in love with Mason?
We're still the same.
Why won't you admit you're in love?
Miri didn't answer. Didn't say she was afraid to call it love, although it was love, and not puppy love, either. It was something much deeper now.
Last week, in Irene's basement, she took his hand and placed it on her breast. It bothered her that he never tried to get to second base, never mind third.
Why didn't he want to go any further with her?
As an experiment, she pulled her sweater over her head. His hands on her naked back were almost more than she could stand. But she didn't stop there. She reached around and unhooked her bra, showing him her breasts. Neither one of them spoke for the longest time. Then he said,
"What are you doing?"
"I want you to touch me."
She took his hands and placed them on her perfect A-cup breasts. She could hear his breath quicken as he ran his hands over them. And she felt something, too, something down there, the way she did at night in her bed when she touched herself.
"It's not a good idea," he said.
"Why?"
she asked, kissing him.
"Suppose I can't stop."
"I'll stop you."
"You don't understand."
"I just wanted to make sure."
"What?"
"That you like me that way."
She put her bra back on, pulled on her sweater.
"And now?"
he asked.
"Now I know you do."
She couldn't tell Natalie, or anyone, how much she cared. Probably Rusty once loved Mike Monsky, or thought she had. And look how that ended.
"What are the girls saying about me?"
Natalie asked, bringing Miri back to the moment.
"They hope you'll get better soon."
"What do they think is wrong with me?"
"None of us knows what's wrong."
"Do they laugh when they talk about me?"
"No. Why would they laugh?"
She would never say that they hardly ever talked about her. She was as removed from their lives as Robo, living in her new house in Milburn, even more removed.
"Because it's funny, isn't it? I didn't even see the crashes, but here I am. My mother says I'm just very sensitive. Do you think I'm sensitive?"
"I guess."
"What about Ruby? What does she think?"
"She abandoned me a while back. Didn't even say goodbye. Didn't even say I'd be okay without her."
"Are you okay without her?"
"What you see is what you get."
"Why are you talking in riddles?"
"That's not a riddle. A riddle would be more like, what's soft and mushy and gray all over?"
Miri didn't have a clue.
"I give up. Natalie's messed up brain. Get it?"
Miri was growing more uncomfortable by the minute. How long did Corinne expect her to stay here?
"Did you hear?" Natalie said. "My father wants us to move to Nevada, to some place called Las Vegas."
"Nevada? But that's so far away, isn't it?"
"Only 2,500 miles.
It takes 5 days to drive there. Some people fly. You have to make 2 or 3 stops. My mother swears she'll never go. They hate each other.
No, they don't.
Ever since the crash that killed Mrs. Barnes's son, all they do is fight. But New Year's Eve, the party, the diamond earrings, all an act. God forbid Corinne's friends think there's trouble in paradise. One time, she slapped his face at a party.
No.
She accused him of flirting with one of her friends. I found out from listening in on a phone call between my mother and Seal Rubin. We all understand, Seal said. Then my mother started crying, and I hung up the extension. That's one good thing about being here. I don't have to listen to them arguing. They never visit at the same time unless the doctors say they have to. Sometimes I think it would be fun to live in Nevada. No plane crashes. I'd have my own horse.
But where would you go to school?
They have schools. At least, I think they do. I'd go anywhere to get out of this place. But first, I have to eat. She jumped up and grabbed a banana from the snack table. I've been eating bananas without throwing up. Next is sweet potatoes. Did you know sweet potatoes are a perfect food? All the vitamins and minerals you could want, wrapped into one tuber. Come on, let's go. She grabbed Miri's hand and led her down the hall, back to her room. I've been studying food groups and science. My tutor, did you know I have a tutor?
No.
She graduated from Teachers College at Columbia. She's Lulu's tutor, too. Natalie pushed open the door to her room. The trouble with Lulu is she wants to die. I don't want to die. I really don't. Miri reached for Natalie's hand, and for just a moment, Natalie looked right into her eyes. Will you miss me if I go?
You know I will.
Did she mean die or move to Nevada? Lulu said, If I wanted to die that badly, I'd be dead by now, Goldilocks. She pulls out her tubes, Natalie said. She tricks the nurses. You know what she has? It's called anorexia nervosa.
You have it too, cutie pie.
Lulu looked at Miri and pointed a finger at Natalie.
She has it too.
You never know if she's telling the truth or lying, Natalie said, with a nod toward Lulu. You can't believe anything she says. If she croaks, I just hope she does it when I'm not around.
I'll remember that, golden one.
See this banana? Natalie said to Miri as she began to peel back the skin.
Don't eat that in front of me or I'll vomit,
Lulu said.
She can't even look at food. I can if it's a picture in a magazine, just not the real stuff, not the smelly stuff.
I have to go outside to eat a banana, Natalie said.
Banana,
she shouted, wagging it in front of Lulu. Lulu gagged and reached for her call button. A nurse came into the room.
What now, Lulu?
She made me gag.
I didn't make her gag, Natalie said. I showed her the banana, that's all. Miri snuck a look at her watch. She wanted to get out of there in the worst way.
I think your mother is waiting for me, she told Natalie.
She picked up the gift-wrapped copy of 17th Summer from the chair where she'd set it down earlier and handed it to Natalie.
I brought this for you.
I hope it's not chocolates.
It's a book.
Let's see,
Lulu said, as Natalie tore the paper off Miri's gift.
17th Summer. How sweet. Are you in love with her?
Lulu asked Miri.
Don't answer that, Natalie said.
Then quietly she told Miri,
I already read it.
I know, Miri said. We read it together. I thought... Lulu started singing.
Be my love.
Shut up, Lulu, Natalie said.
I've got to go, Miri said.
Sure, Natalie said. I don't blame you.
How did she seem? Corinne asked on the way home.
She was good.
Argumentative? Angry?
Miri nodded.
A little.
That's better than depressed. She's eating again. Not a lot. And only a few things, but that's progress. Green grapes, iceberg lettuce, and bananas. Like a chimpanzee.
Corinne gave a sharp laugh.
Oh, God,
I don't know why I said that. Please don't mention that I said that about the chimpanzee.
Miri wanted to say she liked chimpanzees, but she didn't.
Elizabeth Daily Post. Editorial. Reason has its limitations. April 14th. The inflamed mob action which has been taking place in Egypt, Tunisia, Iran, and elsewhere should point a major lesson to democratic Western policymakers, the futility of placing too much faith in logic and reason when dealing with angry, impassioned peoples. Something similar can be seen even here in a few of the more violent and irrational proposals made to combat Newark Airport expansion.
Chapter 30. Steve. On April 15th, Steve got an acceptance letter from Syracuse. Phil got in, too. Just the way they'd planned. Instead of celebrating, Steve went down to Williamson Street and walked around where Kathy died, all the time talking to her, trying to explain what was going on. Or maybe he was trying to explain it to himself. How someone his age, someone beautiful, someone he had dreamed about, someone he had kissed, could have stepped onto a plane one January afternoon and be dead an hour and a half later. How could that happen? How could that be real? So, thanks, but no thanks, Syracuse. He was never setting foot on that campus again, never setting foot in that town, in the whole of upstate New York. Phil was waiting for him when he got home, sitting outside in his car.
I figured you'd come home sooner or later.
Steve shoehorned himself into Phil's MG, an early graduation present from his parents.
I'm not going to Syracuse, Steve told him.
Me neither, Phil said. So which one do you want to go to, Rutgers or Lehigh?
Steve shrugged.
I say Lehigh, Phil said. Put some distance between us and our families.
Okay.
We have to send back our forms with a check.
Okay.
Tomorrow, right?
Sure. Tomorrow.
I'm counting on you,
Phil said.
Don't count on me too much.
What do you mean? We're in this together.
I gotta go,
Steve said, getting out of Phil's car.
He supposed by now his mother had told his father he'd gotten into all three schools he'd applied to, but maybe not, because his mother and father didn't seem to be speaking these days. Life at home was no fun, to put it mildly. Natalie was lucky she was at that rest home. He hoped she was getting plenty of rest, because there was nothing restful about living here. Only Fern carried on as if everything were okay. Maybe that was her way of dealing with it. Pretend everything is fine, same as always. Too bad he couldn't do that. Inside, his parents and Fern were waiting for him in the kitchen.
Congratulations, they called out.
Was this a surprise party? Were his friends hiding in the other room? He looked around, but no, it was just the family, what was left of the family. He supposed he should be grateful. A surprise party was the last thing he wanted. Besides, all his friends would be celebrating with their families tonight, except for the ones who didn't get into their first-choice schools.
Look at your cake, Fern sang. It's your favorite, all chocolate, from Allen's Bakery.
We're proud of you, son,
his father said, throwing an arm over his shoulder. His mother embraced him.
I never doubted you'd do well. Can we eat the cake now?
Fern asked, practically drooling over it.
After Steve has his supper, his mother said, I'll heat up the plate I saved for you.
No, I'll have cake for my supper, Steve said, making Fern clap her hands.
His mother started to protest, but his father said,
You're not going to be there next year to make sure he has supper before dessert. You might as well get used to it.
At which point his mother burst into tears and left the room.
She's just emotional about you leaving home, his father said, trying to reassure him.
Good Natalie's not here, Fern said. She doesn't eat cake.
Elizabeth Daily Post. Desk fax service comes to area.
April 28th. Western Union has introduced an electronic service which provides the busy businessman with a push-button telegraph office right on his desk. The device is the desk fax, a machine